One of the things that really sets Buddhism off from Western religions, this is something I think I've talked about before, but I wanted to come back to it. One of the things that really sets Buddhism off from Western religions, that maybe is even the source of why some people wonder whether Buddhism can be called a religion, is because, I'm going to be self-conscious every time I look at you. Is because, the basic notion of the goal, which is to become a Buddha, is woven into the idea that you already are in some way, deeply within yourself, you have a Buddha nature. So on the one hand, becoming a Buddha is considered a goal, but on the other hand, in a certain way, you're already that. You've already got it. Now some Buddhists take the view that means that it's not so much that you already are a Buddha, but that you have the potential to be a Buddha, that you have the seed of Buddhahood within yourself, and you somehow need to cultivate it. And other Buddhists take the view that, no, I mean, that you are a Buddha already, but there's some way in which you don't know it, you don't act like it, and that you just need to know it and act like it, and that's that. End of story, end of game, end of process. So there are different views about this issue. And it's kind of, in a sense, it's not been resolved within the different Buddhist traditions. And one of the ways of understanding the different traditions, in fact, is on this particular point of view. Do you accumulate the qualities that make you that, or do you sort of release or realize or recognize that nature within yourself, and that's always necessary? So I've wrestled personally with this question a lot. And at different times, I've found myself on both sides of the issue. In fact, it reminds me of a question I was once asked by a professor when I was kind of young and just beginning my own career. I was having a conversation with a senior professor of Buddhist studies at Harvard, and he was asking me what I thought about Carl Jung. Did I think that he really kind of had it right in the way he thought about psychology and human development? And I said, well, kind of on even numbered days I thought he was correct, and on odd numbered days I thought he was wrong. And so in regards to this question of do you have to achieve something or you already have it, I kind of flop back and forth. It's more like even numbered years and odd numbered years, perhaps, than days. I'm not that quixotic, I guess. One of my teachers, someone named Thubten Norbu, said that he had a metaphor for this. He said that if you have some buttermilk, and what you want is you want butter on your toast, you still have to churn the milk. You have to churn the butter on the buttermilk. I mean, the butter is in the milk, but if you want it on your toast, you have to churn it out. You have to do something to get it out, even though it's already there. And so that was sort of a Tibetan view of this particular issue. Yeah, it's there, but you have to do something to bring it forth. And I think that I found that very helpful. And I guess I must still find it helpful because it's obviously still on my mind. I mean, I still remember it. He told me many things. He taught me many things, as our teachers do. But how much do we remember? I guess we remember the stuff that really had an impact, so this must have had an impact. Anyway, I think that this quandary has been significant for Americans, that this has been a significant issue for Americans. Although I'm not sure that it's always been sort of conceptualized or expressed in the way in which I just expressed it. I know that when I was much younger and had lots of friends who had taken lots of drugs and had all kinds of visionary type of experiences as a result of that, the question came up a lot about spiritual practice, and especially spiritual practice in relationship to having a teacher. And a lot of people would say, now the teacher's within me, I don't really need a teacher. My inner self can be my own guide, and that's really all that I need. And, you know, I think that there was some good sense to that, because there are a lot of people who got into very complicated and unwholesome relationships with teachers because they didn't exactly understand what that type of relationship was in the Asian tradition. And they sort of approached it from their own Western point of view and with their own difficulties with authority figures and so on and so forth, and sometimes things went well and sometimes they didn't go so well. But, you know, what they were wrestling with was the question of what is their relationship with their Buddha nature? You know, I mean, if you think of Buddhahood as this exalted state, which maybe many people are referencing when they talk about the spiritual realization in some way, if they're talking about God even, especially talking about God in an immanent sense rather than a transcendent sense. You know, what is your relationship with that within yourself? And that's something that was really problematic for a lot of people. Maybe that's not the right word. They're pretty sure they knew what that was about. And yet if you looked kind of at how they lived and their emotional life and how they treated each other, sometimes you really would have to wonder what kind of relationship they had with what, because it didn't seem like they were expressing some deep spiritual quality of themselves in the relationship with each other. So this is what I've been thinking about from the point of view of what I want to talk about this evening, is if the goal of practice is to achieve that deepest quality of ourselves, the essence of what we are, our own Buddha nature, and we take the view that whether it's something that we want to cultivate and develop, and we have a seed within us, or we take the view that it's already there, fully developed within us, and somehow we just have to, you know, release it or be, you know, allow it to come forth in some way. There's still something that seems to separate us from it, and we don't really express it, and we don't feel deeply satisfied within ourselves. Because, you know, I mean, if we're really deeply in touch with this part of ourselves, I don't think we would drive ourselves as crazy as we do. I mean, for lack of a... not having a more sophisticated way to speak about it right now, but we do. We drive ourselves crazy, you know. And we drive other people crazy around us. And we wouldn't do that if we were completely engaged with that deepest part of ourselves. So this... excuse me, I have a sore spot in my right thigh here. So this... so this thing of our driving each other and ourselves crazy because we're disconnected or not fully engaged or whatever with this deep part of ourselves is actually spoken of in Buddhist thought, and it's kind of a critical issue. In fact, the oldest Buddhist traditions pretty much are in accordance with the idea that what stands between sort of us on the surface, the, our ordinary personality, if you will, and our deepest self is what they, what is sometimes translated as taints or distortions might be a good word, because the root is actually a cognitive, it's actually a cognitive problem. But the easiest thing is probably to use the Sanskrit term so that we don't carry some conventional Western ideas forward about it, which is klesha. And a klesha is a bad habit pattern. A klesha is like a stain on the mind, if you want to use that kind of language. Is the distortion. And the main thing is that it's a distortion of how we understand. I mean, in the Western traditions, in the Catholic tradition, for example, the problem that as human beings, the problem that we have is our sinful nature. I think that might be the way to describe it. And our sinful nature has to do with various kinds of unwholesome emotions. Although, by some theologies, we're born with a kind of a problematic nature. So when we approach this question of what are the kleshas, we approach it from a point of view that has a long Western tradition, so we've got a lot of baggage in the way we tend to think about it. So it's very hard to think about kleshas or taints or distortions or what covers up our Buddha nature without the Western baggage. So, you know, if you're an Indian or a Chinese or a Tibetan, you're kind of approaching it without the Judeo-Christian heritage. And that's impossible for us to do. I mean, even abstractly, I think that's pretty much impossible for us to do. So it's kind of, it's important to recognize that that's going on. So, for example, in sometimes if you read books on Buddhism, sometimes you run across the word sin. And when you do the Vajrasattva meditation, Bob Thurman, who did that, put the word sin in there. I don't know why he did that, quite frankly. He's really an incredible translator. Maybe he just couldn't think of a better term to put in there. But but klesha is not sin in the way in which we tend to think about sin. Klesha is a funny kind of a distortion of cognition. Because the root problem for Buddhists and the fundamental thing that essentially separates us from our deepest nature, from our Buddhist nature, is the way we think about things, is our cognition, the way we understand things. But the root problem is simply that we tend to view things in ways that are distorted based upon our language, based upon our personal history, based upon the way we were raised in this life, and so on and so forth. But all the ways in which we understand things have a twist to them, have a distortion to them. And over long periods of time, cognizing with that kind of distortion or being in relationship to people with distorted ideas leaves traces, leaves habits. So we develop habits that reinforce negative points of view. We reinforce habits that, we develop habits that reinforce misunderstanding or misknowledge. The fundamental problem, again, to reiterate in Buddhist thought, is that we have this misunderstanding, these distortions, these incorrect ways of understanding what is happening in our experience. That these things perpetuate themselves, and by perpetuating themselves, they reinforce these distortions, these misunderstandings, which further keep us disconnected from our fundamental nature. So the good news is that because it's a cognitive problem, it can be addressed with changes in the way we think, changes in the way we feel, changes in the way we understand that there are actually mental things you can do and you can free yourself from those things. One way of understanding what they are, what are these clashes, what are these taints, if you will, what are these distortions, is that we tend to overestimate or underestimate the characteristics of things. And this is a term that I ran into when I was actually doing some translating. And I have to be honest to say I don't know what the technical Sanskrit or Tibetan is for that, but the person who used that language knew what he was talking about, so it was based on something. He happened to be very specific about it. But the way what he meant by this was that, and it's like you have a nice dinner at one of the Cedars, and you're pretty much full. Don't really need to eat anything else. And the waitress says, "Would you like some dessert?" And, you know, one part of you says, "No, I don't really need to eat anything." But you don't really say no because you're kind of curious. And she rattles off this list of things that are available for dessert. And one of them might be, for example, a strawberry shortcake. We had this experience. And so immediately you think about strawberry shortcake and how wonderful it was to have some strawberry shortcake. And then your mind kind of engages and you have this whole, you create an image and you have memories and so on and so forth. And you think, yeah, I want some. You know, it's like you're not even hungry, but some other part of you comes forth and wants some strawberry shortcake. And then it shows up, and it's not the way it was when you ordered it last time, for one thing, because it can't be. Right? But you eat it anyway. So it's probably not as good. I mean, the odds are it could be better. You know, but the point is that whatever it is that you thought it was going to be isn't what shows up and is not what the experience is that you have. Because you either overestimate how wonderful the thing was based upon your memory, you know, or you underestimate something, like you might underestimate how sick you're going to feel after you eat it. But the point is that you don't typically engage with things for what they actually are as they're being presented to you. And you can, you know, you don't have to get really sophisticated about this. It becomes pretty almost self-apparent when you think about it. You know, you can run down the list of just about anything. I mean, and I've kind of gotten, in a funny way, I've gotten used to it because I really hate shopping. So being in the brand from a certain point of view is not a problem for me. But, you know, I like clothes that fit. And, you know, I like, if I want a certain something that's a certain color, you know, I expect it to be that color and, you know, be constructed in a certain way and whatnot. But pretty much everything that I buy on the internet. Because, you know, Penny's and Walmart just only get you so far. You know, and I'm not going to drive to Portland for a shirt or something like that. But I've gotten used to the idea that no matter what it is that I buy on the internet, whatever I think it is, it's not what's going to show up in the mail. Right? So that's a good example of it. It's not what's going to show up in the mail. What shows up in the mail is, it could be superior to what I thought it was going to be, or it could be inferior to what I thought it was going to be. One thing that's for certain is whatever shows up in the mail is not what I thought it was going to be. You know? So that's kind of a good metaphor for overestimating and underestimating experience. You know? Sort of like falling in love is like this. I mean, I don't want to dash any ideas about romantic love, but as soon as you develop these kinds of strong emotional attachments with people, you're no longer seeing them for what they are. You know, you're seeing them for what you want them to be, and you're seeing them for the emotions that they elicit, good, bad, or indifferent. But as soon as you fall in love with somebody, you're no longer in a relationship with that actual person, which, I mean, it could be really wonderful. You know, you could have two people who are in relationship with each other, and they're in relationship with a fantasized other who is so wonderful that you have this whole other kind of thing going on fantasy zone. This the kind of power in your relationship is quite exciting. It's quite nice. But then over time, you know, reality and fantasy have to come together in some sort of way. And I think for most people, that tends not to be a very happy thing. But You know, it could be. It could be a wonderful thing as you discover who that real other person actually is. But when that happens, what also happens is you have to discover who you really are and what was going on inside of you that, you know, generated all the fantasy and distorted notions. So that's, I think, as it turns out, I didn't plan on going in this direction. For a married guy sitting here with his wife and sons, dangerous territory. But, you know, I mean, what does happen in you know, in spiritual practice, when you start thinking about, well, the kleshas, the distortions, are really the problem, you know, that's underlying why you're dissatisfied in your personal relationship with yourself, let alone with anybody else. When you start engaging with these things, you get this kind of quality of honesty as the overestimations and the underestimations are pulled into harmony with what's actually going on in you or with the other person. And of course, a relationship of some duration and commitment, whatever, whether it's marriage or working relationship or anything, you know, I mean, if you stick with it and people are relatively honest with each other, you know, you start having to look at yourself and in the sense of your own behaviors, your own emotions, your own thoughts, what you say, so on and so forth. And, you know, I mean, if you adopt the point of view that, in fact, there are a lot of distortions at work in what's going on, and that whatever you think about what's happening is probably wrong, then you stand some chance of discovering what's actually going on. And as you start to discover what's actually going on, then you have the opportunity to see your habit patterns at work and see your distortions at work and start looking for long-range patterns, if you will, or patterns that connect or threads that tie certain sort of types of distortions together. You see certain characteristics. I mean, for example, to speak about myself, because in these sort of situations, that's usually the safest thing to do, even if it's only slightly true. It's a lot better than trying to talk about something else. I've spent a lifetime pretty much not having much faith in myself and not seeing myself as having probably as much capacity to do whatever as I actually did. So that I would kind of undermine opportunities that were given to me destroy opportunities because I didn't really think that I could do something or that I was good enough or that I was qualified or, you know, whatever it would be. So after a while, you sort of start to see that and then you have to deal with that. And so that's an example of underestimating my own character. And then the problem, of course, is that you can look at that and then you get to ask yourself, was that a way of avoiding your own arrogance? Because really, what was at work? Because underestimation goes along with overestimation. They're never independent of each other. So if you're kind of walking around spending a lot of time thinking, I'm no good, I'm inadequate, I can't do, I'm not worthy, then at a certain point you've got to ask yourself, to what extent am I just arrogant? You know, that I really think I'm better than everybody else in some way, and that these two things go together. Now, I can't necessarily explain how, you know, arrogance and lack of self-esteem go together, but they do. And there are a lot of things that are like that. So at some point you finally, you know, look at that process and you say it's neither this thing or the other thing, you know. And you finally see what's actually happening. You see the actual behavior, the actual person, the actual characteristics of certain patterns that you have. And that's kind of, you know, hard and humbling in some ways. But when you see that, then you also see why it is that there's you, there's Buddha, and there's something in between you and Buddha, and there it is, and you can see it. can see it real clearly. So it's the work of a lifetime, or many lifetimes, if you have to think that way. When that happens, then you're faced with another question. You start seeing that stuff. You're faced with another question, which is, what do you do about it? And how do you feel about it? Because the mind is real tricky. And then what you'll slide into with all these things, I think we're all not going to be surprised to discover, is another version of the same thing, which is, man, I really, you know, what's wrong with me? Okay, so that's, okay, the other, the mind is at it again, you know, and it's overestimating and underestimating something in relationship to the way your ego is relating to this realization about yourself. And you just get into the endless, endless cycle of this kind of stuff. So the question is, what do you do with that endless cycle? Because it'll come up when you're meditating. You'll be sitting, and something will happen, and you know, it'll show you something about yourself, and it's, and you'll be sitting with that, and it'll come back to you when you're meditating. You know, it seems like a big distraction in some way, and it is a big distraction in some way. But on the other hand, it's true in another way. And so you can't forget about it, but you can't get obsessed about it either. So the metaphor that I like for this, that exists in most of the Buddhist traditions, is that when you're practicing and this stuff comes up, again, you don't want to push it away, and you don't want to grab onto it too tightly. It's another, like, don't fall into overestimating and underestimating, and when your mind relates to the thoughts that flow through that are going to captivate you because they're associated with some true realization about yourself. So you grab it, and you can obsess about it, say whatever you want about yourself, and watch your mind go. Or you can say, I don't want to look at it, and push it out of the way. You know. So think of your mind as being like the sky. Think of your consciousness, think of your nature as being like the sky, and these thoughts are like clouds that flow through. You know, they're going to come in, and they're going to go out of their own accord. And you don't have to pay a lot of attention to them, but you don't want to ignore them either. Just let them flow through like clouds floating through the sky, and then they'll pass away. And then you can see them, but not get hooked on them. And you can understand what the kleshas are. You can start seeing them. You can see the kleshas in your own experience clearly at that particular point. But you don't get distressed about them either, because like, the worst thing that can happen is, I am so screwed up. You know, I'm so screwed up. I'm such a mess. I'm, you know, it's an interesting self-indulgence, you know. So you just sort of let those things float on through. And that the spaciousness that's there, that those things are floating through, is your actual Buddha nature. You know? And so it reveals itself in that way. And you calmly can sort of settle into it a little bit more. And then, you know, something else will come up and will float through, because we're ordinary human beings. You know, we go to work in the morning, and the boss is grouchy, or you've got ticket on all your work, and, you know, and it's a hassle because it's going to cost you a bunch. Or, you know, in California, and then you had to go to traffic school, which is usually a drag. That's not the way I want to spend my Saturday. I don't want to go to traffic school. Okay, so you get to work in your crummy mood. And, you know, so then all that stuff is there. But, so it'll be endless. It'll be endless. I mean, the practice and the path is endless in that respect. But the thing that's interesting is then you can say, well, shoot, you know, am I ever going to realize anything? Am I ever going to achieve anything? Because I'm always wrapped up in this gunk all the time, you know, the kleshas, the distortions. Well, but you are. Because in those moments when, you know, you can actually just see these things as the clouds that are floating through, in those little moments, they may not be a lot of them, they may be rare, you know, but they do occur, in that moment of spaciousness, you're in a peaceful place. And you'll experience that. You're in a peaceful place. And everything is okay for that moment. And then the next moment, you know, someone will call you on the phone and bug you and be irritated and have a negative reaction or something like that. You catch it. All right, I'm not going to clear it again. You chill. Everything's okay for a little while. And you're in and out, in and out, in and out. So that's really kind of the human thing. And so this question of, you know, do I have a Buddha nature? Do I need to cultivate a Buddha nature? Do I need a teacher? Can I be my own teacher? I think the answer to all these things, get them revealed, you know, in a way that's meaningful to each of us, in that spaciousness, in that space. You know, the cloud is just sort of going through, the thoughts are just sort of going through. The actual answers to those questions, not the thought answers, not the received, you know, this is what the tradition says answers. This is not what my mind says answers. Not those answers come forward, but the real answer. The answer that comes from being in a place and knowing something by just being there, that comes forth. But those ones are answered in that way. So, that's it for you, yeah, for me. Yeah. We can talk more about this after. Do you want meditation? If you want.